It's Wednesday, August the 11th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. With me today are Jennifer Bray and Jack Horgan-Jones from our political staff. Hi, guys.
Morning.
Hi, Hugh.
Last week we were discussing the grand sweep of American politics with Suzanne Lynch, so we didn't actually get the chance to tease out the details of some of the recent political developments closer to home. So that's what we're going to do today. And I suppose, Jen, we have to start with the backwash or the aftermath or the last legs of what has come to be known as Saponagate.
Yes, or Mariangate, depending on which Twitter hashtag you follow. I mean, it's worth reminding ourselves, you know, why exactly this became an issue and why it is such a big story. And that's because in the very last cabinet of the year before the summer, the government rubber stamped the appointment of Catherine Zapone as special envoy for freedom of expression. It became very obvious that this was problematic when it emerged that the Taoiseach at that cabinet was blindsided and had no idea that this appointment was coming to the table. And that became sort of the story the next day. And it sort of took on a momentum of its own because all through the last year of government, we've seen Sinn Féin in opposition and they've pledged to be, you know, the most effective and outspoken opposition that there has been in the history of the state. And they have made it very clear that their message about Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, lesser so the Green Party, but Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, is that they're two parties that are the peas in a pod, that they are representing an elite, that they are in an insider circle, and that they all look after each other, and that there's a lot of cronyism and political strokes and all that kind of stuff. And we've seen those charges levelled across the floor of the Dáil many, many times. And I think when this appointment came up on the very last cabinet of the year, it was perfect opportunity for them to actually say, well, look, here is an example of this. And people did want to know what was the process behind appointing Catherine Zapone, because obviously she was a minister in the last administration and was quite close to the Fine Gael ministers in particular. It became pretty apparent very quickly that there was no process in place, that this was something that was, I mean, Simon Coveney said in a very cranky interview that it wasn't a makey-uppy job, was the phrase that he used. But the fact of the matter was there was nobody else considered for it. And there was a bit of confusion around, did she put herself forward or was she approached by Simon Coveney, or how did it work? And we actually still don't know the full details of that. And I'd say journalists across the country are flat out pouring in the FOIs to the different departments to try and get the paper trail and get to the bottom of exactly what happened there. So the story is kind of, I wouldn't say trundling along, but definitely rolling along at a normal pace. And we got to around day 10 of the saga. And that's, you know, when people like Alistair Campbell say that if you're still a story on day 10, then you're political toast. And, you know, then it came out via the Irish Independent that she had attended or organised an event in the Merrion Hotel for around 50 people, which was attended by Leo Varadkar of Anabatchik and Donal Gagan of the Green Party. And that this came at a time when there were ambiguity around the rules for outside gatherings. Restaurants and hotels had no idea you could have up to 200 people outdoors. And then we had the extraordinary intervention of the Attorney General via the government information services, saying that he clarified you could have up to 200 people outdoors, and then the claims that was a politicisation of the Attorney General's office. It was kind of an extraordinary turn of events, really. And of course, where it left us all was that Catherine Zapone stepped down from that role as special envoy. I think she cited the criticism of the role, and questions then were asked about who else was at that party, and you know, how come there was so much ambiguity around the rules, and what does this mean for Leo Varadkar as Taoiseach? And now, of course, they've all gone on their holidays. I wouldn't say they're in hiding, because in fairness, they are all off on holidays, and it has been a very bruising 15 or 16 months for them. But I get the impression that this story isn't finished. I get the impression that this is not the end of what we're going to hear about it. And I think it will rumble on into the start of the Dáil term, because the Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs want to sit down and bring in Simon Coveney and ask him all the questions, like the outstanding questions I mentioned around how exactly this came to be.
Yeah, Jack, I mean, for what my view is a relatively small story in reality, there's an awful lot in there, including what the job was in the first place, which, you know, is still unclear to me. I'm personally not that perturbed by the fact that, even though, as Jen says, it gives Sinn Féin a stick to beat Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil with, about cronyism, about an appointment of this sort being made in this way, in my knowledge, there's been appointments like this, cultural ambassadors and stuff like that, which have been made in the past on the basis of people being on the ground in certain countries. And that's where Zapone lives in New York. But then there's all this stuff about conniptions within Fine Gael, people leaking, people getting caught out leaking, that what seems to be more interesting about it, and the use of the Attorney General as well, which raises some big questions, is a sense that that this is a kind of indicative of a certain malaise at the highest ranks in Fine Gael. Is that a correct read, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that one of the key takeaways
from the fallout of all this is that everyone is kind of annoyed a bit with Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar about this. In the first instance, with Coveney for either not identifying the political risk attendant to this or trying to kind of slip it in at the last minute on a cabinet agenda and hope nobody noticed. So, like, it wasn't apparently on the cabinet agenda that was circulated in advance of cabinet. It wasn't kind of taken out for a walk or socialised with advisors beforehand. And apparently the first time Micheál Martin heard about it was when it went to cabinet. So you have the kind of Fianna Fáil side of government very annoyed about this. And, you know, as I understand it, ministers are furious over it. And you also have a slightly more interesting dynamic whereby a lot of people in Fine Gael are annoyed about it as well. It's not universal, but there is anger out there. And I think that it kind of comes back to a sense that the kind of leadership of Fine Gael has been in cabinet, including Simon Coveney, for, you know, a decade or so. And perhaps they're that little bit detached from the backbenches and the grassroots. And they're not able to kind of detect things that will be politically problematic for people in those ranks as and when they kind of come up to leadership level. And then that annoyance has extended across to the fact that Leo Varadkar was at the Mariengate event. And certainly in Fianna Fáil, there's huge resentment of the fact that, like, they see this, a lot of people in Fianna Fáil see this as the second time in a little over a calendar year where Leo Varadkar has done something that they've kind of had to throw themselves on the grenade afterwards, the first being the leaking of the GP contract. Something that would be of the scale to be a very serious problem for a normal cabinet line minister, but because Varadkar is who he is, and this is the take that's being offered, because Varadkar is who he is and because he's a leader and because anything that affects him affects the stability of the coalition, they have to go out and bat for him, and they're not happy for it. And they're not happy that last week, other than Colin Brophy and Sean Kine, who aren't kind of A-list kind of media performers usually, there was no Fine Gael cabinet minister put out. It took until Saturday, and then the Taoiseach put out a statement, so it's a Fianna Fáil minister putting in a statement, and then Jack Chambers goes out on Sunday to talk about it, and Fine Gael are nowhere to be found until, I think it was Monday or Tuesday this week, when Pascal Donoghue comes out. There's also deep resentment, and, you know, people are on the record about this. I mean, Timmy Dooley gave us quotes about this last week, and I think Willie O'Dea was in the Sunday Independent talking about it as well. There's great annoyance around the kind of what people see as the kind of the reverse engineering of Attorney General advice for political expediency. So the Government Information Service put out a statement last week outlining effectively how the event in the Merion was in keeping with regulations. And then Leo Varadkar put out a statement that made this point even more bluntly. You know, he was saying, look, I'm sorry, but, you know, if you look at the Attorney General advice, it was okay. And people are very annoyed about that. They see that as the politicization of the role of the AG. And overall, when you take a step back from it, it's more than end-of-term crankiness. It speaks to more kind of profound issues about coherence and commonality of purpose and all those kind of old issues that have plagued the coalition from the get-go. And it shows that all these things are just under the surface at all times. And it can take something relatively minor where, if that minor incident is mismanaged and mismanaged in a serial way across the several different phases and several different news cycles, it can really become a problem that extends beyond grumpiness and can undermine the coalition more substantially than that without undermining it fatally. I don't think we're at the point, even though, you know, some people have been kind of excitedly suggesting, oh, is there going to be a heave or something like that? We're not at that point, but we are somewhere between that point and just normal levels of grumpiness.
Yeah, I mean, I remember this time last year, Jen, you know, everything seemed to be going wrong for the then still very, very young government. And one of the things I think that happened was then August came and there was the, you know, the political catastrophe for the government of Golfgate and various other issues. But it seemed to give them, I suppose, a kick in the arse, ultimately. And they did then get their act together as they moved into the autumn period and seemed to kind of, everything seemed to calm down and everything seemed to get a little bit more competent. Is there some chance that this incident, however important or unimportant it is in itself, might have a similar effect this year?
Yeah, I think it will. Also, I think it's almost unfortunate for the government in a way that this story landed and that this happened right at the entrance to what we traditionally deem silly season, which most people will know that's when you start seeing stories in the papers about, you know, a new panda in Dublin Zoo, all that kind of stuff to fill. It's very difficult to fill those pages during summer. That wasn't the case last summer, in fairness, with COVID and other issues. But yeah, I think it came at a time when political correspondents and everybody else could all collectively look into the story and dig into it together. And that gave a kind of a bigger prominence as well. But I think it might not be an issue, a massive issue going into the new term. Like I said, I do think it will live on for quite some time, but it will be one of many things that are added to almost the file, if you know what I mean. And you know the phrase, there's the straw that breaks the camel's back. This will be one of the straws, I think, that add up to the entire bail. And it leaves a long-term impression, I think, if you take it away from, I suppose, the internal, you know, machinisms inside Leinster House, it does leave a lingering effect on the public perception of Fine Gael and of those ministers and of how a government and does its business. So I think that's a real problem for them.
Can I ask you, Jen, is there a real malaise within Fine Gael? I mean, any party that's been in power, as Fine Gael has been for 10 years, tends to have to confront problems of hubris and detachment from the way normal people lead their lives. And then I have an added sense when I look at the most senior levels of the party at the moment. They've had two very bad elections, one after the other, and there doesn't seem to have been a proper post-mortem in either case. And I get the sense when I look at Leo Varadkar, possibly Pascal Donoghue as well, that they lose the next election, they're not necessarily committed in the long haul to the party. There's probably other things they'd rather be doing.
Yeah, a lot of people have the impression as well, that impression too, that they're the senior politicians like Leo Varadkar, Simon Coveney, Pascal Donoghue, that they are eyeing up, you know, a big job in the EU and that they see their fortunes beyond politics. And I think a couple of years ago, Leo Varadkar kind of fell foul of this when he was talking about he didn't see himself in politics beyond a certain age or beyond a certain date, which made people, you know, gave rise to accusations that he was only in it for, you know, short-termism kind of goal. I do agree with you, actually. I do think there is kind of a hubris. I definitely think there's almost an exhaustion that they've been in government for so long. They're so used to it. Because I remember in the last election when different parties were trying to form a government, if you remember, Fine Gael stood back and said, well, that's that election result. That's us destined for the opposition now. We're going straight into opposition. And people speculated at the time, is this just a tactic so that they can give Sinn Féin the chance to try and form a government and then fail and put them out front and centre while they wait for their next turn, basically. But I definitely got the impression at the time that they were kind of hands in the air going, right, well, that's fine. We're going into opposition. That's where we're destined to be. And then, of course, look, we had the pandemic. That changed everything. And I think that revitalised people in Fine Gael as well. Like, they found themselves on the side of the public for the first time in a long time, I think, because they did actually get widespread backing for how they handled the pandemic in the early days. Like, if you remember the incredible turn of fortunes for Simon Harris, you know, he was, I would say, by some people credited for bringing down the last government in that there was a motion of no confidence due in him. And that the independents, the government had lost the support of those key independents. And that was it, really. That was when we had the Leo Varadkar calling the general election. He went from that position to being one of the most respected ministers by the public. I mean, if you go onto his Instagram page now and look at the comments that are left under his stories about being on holidays or the day's work he's just done, they're all like, you're brilliant, you're great. It's like incredible. You don't see that on social media. You just don't. And I think he has that kind of, no, I wouldn't call it a fan base, but definitely sort of a long-running respect. And I think they had that reversal of fortunes during the pandemic. And now they're coming back over to the other side where, you know, people are looking at them and thinking, is this more of the same? And I do get the impression that some of them think, well, look, worst comes to worst. I've been doing this job for a very long time. I can get another job somewhere else. But there are the backbenchers in particular, I think, are upset at how the story has played out. And there is another element too about Catherine Zappone and Fine Gael. Like, if you remember, a couple of years ago, it was Catherine Zappone who contradicted Enda Kenny, and it like basically eventually led to his downfall when they were talking about who knew what about Tusla and Maurice McCabe and that awful saga. And there are many people in Fine Gael who think that she was instrumental and that she caused a massive blow in their credibility, and that here she is again for this role that's, as some TDs say, isn't massive pay, creating this massive controversy. So there's an element of that too, kind of them stepping on the same trap again. And how much it means for the leadership of Leo Varadkar remains to be seen, I think.
Yeah, I wonder now as we go into the next political calendar year and we approach this handover, this sort of unprecedented handover from one party to another, whether those tensions both within Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil will start coming more to the fore or resurfacing. But Jen mentioned COVID there, Jack, and it hasn't gone away, as we know. Numbers are increasing, both in terms of overall positive tests and to some extent hospitalizations also. were in a kind of an interregnum. There was a lot of fuss and bother in June about the regulations brought in relation to opening pubs and restaurants and all the rest of it. I gather NPHET isn't meeting for the next couple of weeks, but the government has promised a significant announcement in relation to regulations in the autumn to come before the end of August. So that's really not that far away.
Yeah, it was an interesting little breadcrumb that they just kind of slipped into the statement that went out last Friday after the Cabinet COVID subcommittee met, where they said that effectively, before August is out, a roadmap for the easing or removal of remaining restrictions will be published. There's going to be a particular emphasis around live events, sporting events, arts and culture and so on, and a kind of return to normality and what has been trailed, or, you know, a return to a more normal version of the new normal, if you bear with me. And what has been trailed is that there's going to be a kind of a mass simplification of regs and guidelines and all the rest of it, partially flowing from the furore that followed over Merriongate and, you know, regs and guidelines and advice and law being in conflict at different times. You know, there is this kind of insane mishmash of all of the above interacting over how we live in COVID times. So I think they're going to try and move to a more simplified stance where, you know, some things aren't allowed, but many things are, and you might not get kind of, you know, nitty gritty guidelines on every single iteration of human activity, ranging from going to the cinema to holding a wedding. That may be the direction travel that we're moving in. We have to wait and see what they come out with at the end of August. But I think that could be an interesting and significant moment. And we're going to start to see, I think, in the next kind of 10 days, 2 weeks, the various constituent parts of the COVID policymaking machine coming back together to start thinking about that. So there was supposed to be an NPHET meeting last week. It was cancelled effectively because there's nothing substantial to think about at the moment in terms of changing policy. There's no COVID subcommittee this week, but there is one next week. And then I think the following week after that is when we'll see NPHET meet. So that's the week beginning the 23rd of August. And then we'll probably see a COVID cabinet subcommittee meeting and perhaps a full cabinet then early the following week. So a week commencing the 30th of August to think about these kind of things, and also to think about the most important thing that the government faces in the next little while, and the biggest risk they face in the next little while, which is the reopening of schools. And there is nothing to suggest that the reopening of schools at the moment is in danger, but we are at a very tricky and unprecedented time in the kind of broad span of COVID history, whereby we have case numbers which at any other stage would have us absolutely 110% in lockdown. But because of the effect of vaccines, we're actually still moving in an unwinding direction. And trying to figure out how those two things interact and, you know, what a meaningful level of COVID hospitalization is in a world where you're still running non-COVID care and scheduled care and all the rest of it, and trying to figure out where the new thresholds and where the new kind of danger points and inflection points are when lockdown isn't on the menu is a tricky thing that the kind of the centre is thinking about at the minute. So that's the kind of COVID scene as we head back towards big set pieces like reopening schools.
And do either of you have any idea what the general sense is, either in the political establishment or indeed the medical establishment on that? I mean, Jen, as Jack says there, that I think the word used by the government flagging that there'll be some decisions made by the end of the month was easing. And the general implication is that, you know, that these numbers are high, but things are different now because of the vaccine. Delta operates in a different way. You look across Europe at other countries, they're doing all kinds of things that we're not doing. With my arts and culture editor hat on, I've got to say it seems bizarre to me that, you know, 150 people can pile into a pub, but only 50 people are allowed into a theatre or a cinema that might have a capacity of 1,000 people. So there's all those sorts of anomalies there, which are causing more and more strain. So is the general sense, yes, that despite the direction of travel of the numbers at the moment, we will get a further easing as well as a simplification announced by the end of August?
Yeah, I think so. I think the first thing obviously they look at is the trajectory of the disease, not only where we're at now, but what the modelling predicts. And we can see now that the case numbers, they're high, but they're relatively holding steady. You know, they haven't reached those kind of stratospheric levels we were at in January, thank God. What they're really keeping an eye on, though, is the level of hospitalisation and the level of admissions to the intensive care units. Those hospitalisation numbers have been creeping up very slowly, and then they kind of steadied a bit. It's not exponential growth, but it is still enough to make them concerned. ICU numbers are remaining like pretty steady. And I think that that's given them great cause for I wouldn't say celebration, but definitely relief. And so they look at the disease trajectory, they look at what the, and the modelling shows, and that they expect that we haven't peaked yet and that we will peak somewhere around the end of August. And that once we get past that peak, you're kind of, you know, on the next path here. So once taken into account the disease, then they have to look at the vaccination programme, the campaign. And we've seen, I think it's 89% of adults have been offered or have had at least one dose. And somewhere in the 70% for adults having had been fully vaccinated, which are incredible numbers, really. And nobody expected that we would be here this soon in August. And to the government's great credit, and particularly the health service, really, is that we are here. So you take the disease trajectory, you take the vaccination programme, and then look at what remaining restrictions we have. And like you said, Hugh, the remaining restrictions we have are in the live entertainment sector, the arts sector, culture and arts sector, offices, obviously working is another big area, and indoor activities. These are the biggies that are kind of remaining. And the plan is at the moment, keep all the restrictions for August till we get past that peak that they're expecting. Wait till the disease falls, disease levels fall. Keep up with the vaccination campaign. Maybe get as many as 12, 15-year-olds vaccinated as possible ahead of them going back to school, as Jack mentioned, schools. And keep all those other measures that we have at the moment, like testing, tracing, isolation. And then, of course, we have the booster campaign somewhere down, not too far down the road, but just within sight. They want to take all those things together. And then what they will do is at the very end of August, release what they're calling a roadmap. So what you can expect to see from that is those different areas I mentioned, plans for how many people can attend those events, at what stage, when that will increase, what the situation is about working from the office. Many people want to know that. And of course, any remaining restrictions on indoor activities. So you expect it to be very quiet until you reach a peak, and you know they won't be too alarmed that the figures go up too much. It's what they expect. And then afterwards in September, you know, the idea that we're being given is that this is the next phase of the pandemic. And please God, there's not some gamma variant or something like that to go and throw a spanner in the works at that stage, you know.
Well, indeed. And Jack, I suppose, you know, you look across the water and actually the British government or the English government in this case first, and then the Scottish government, you know, started relaxing measures while the numbers were still on the increase due to the Delta variant. And they continued to rise, and the UK government was willing to take that on board. And now they've gone down and they've plateaued, and they still seem to be on a downward curve. Any chance that the Irish government will therefore end up announcing its own Freedom Day?
I don't think Micheál Martin is in a kind of Boris Johnson Freedom Day mold, to be honest. I think he's way too kind of instinctively conservative to do something like that. But like, look, you talk to people at the centre government, and the hope, nay expectation, is that the path of infection will proceed along the same lines as the UK, where you had this peak. They didn't really change course, and it seemed to collapse anyway. And you talk to people at the centre of the kind of healthcare response, and they're a little bit confused by this. You know, they're kind of trying to muddle through exactly what happened. I know that in Scotland, they're basically putting it down to the football. It's people, you know, it's the Scotland in the Euros, and people going out a lot, and people going down to London, and disease spreading associated with that. And when Scotland were, some would say, inevitably knocked out of the Euros, that stepped back a little bit. And also there seems to have been a kind of a wider sense that the population got a bit spooked by the level of disease that was out there and changed the way they were socializing. And that's one of the theories around why cases came down. I mean, it's funny, it's hard to read too much into the case totals here, because they're not, as Jen said, it's not exponential growth. It seems to be this kind of gear shift growth where you get a jump every so often, associated with probably with something that happened about 10 days beforehand. So we had a jump to 1,800 Friday, Saturday, Sunday of last week, and that's probably indoor dining. But then it doesn't really grow, or it drops down again like it has in the last couple of days, and people are trying to figure out exactly what's going on. And they don't really know. It could be a behavioural thing. And trying to square all those various circles and figure out what the disease is going to do next and figure out how that interacts with policy is obviously a core challenge at the moment.
The most important news story was none of these, by the way. I would say, Jen, today it was the very stark warnings issued this week about the sooner than expected and, in fact, immediate impacts of climate change happening right now, and even more foreboding warnings about what's coming down the line unless we do something about carbon.
Yeah, and I think that report that came out, you know, it's obviously a major report, huge involvement from across the world to get that over the line. And I think it terrified people a little bit because, you know, when you see code red for humanity, right when you're hopefully coming out of a pandemic, I think there's a lot of people who thought, oh, great, that's exactly what we need now, a code red for humanity. But I think there is a realisation, and there has been a realisation in government for quite some time, that this will be one of the most difficult tasks that they have in every way coming into the next couple of years, married alongside the housing crisis, obviously. And I think the big task for the government in light of this report, which shows that, you know, they're basically we are driving this problem, you know, categorically stating that factually, and that much of the climate change we're seeing could be irreversible. What we're going to see the government do over the next couple of weeks is they're going to come out with a series of different plans. They'll have, firstly, the National Development Plan, which will set out, which basically that just says which departments' projects are going to go ahead, be funded, etc. And then you'll have the Climate Plan, which will be a biggie. And then you'll have the budget. And the big task, I think, for the government will be to explain to people exactly what it is that needs to be done in a way that isn't full of jargon. Because I think so much of the climate conversation can be filled with stuff that people, not that they don't understand, but the nitty gritty of it. Like, I mean, people have busy lives and jobs and families and all that. I mean, it's not fair, I think, to expect people to understand all of the detail. So I think their job will be to explain exactly what sectors need to change and exactly what they need to do themselves. And also to be like, we saw through the pandemic, through the very dark days, one of the most important things to do is to offer the public hope that this thing, you know, isn't beyond control, that we can get on top of it. And they'll have to do that as well with the climate change debate. And I had a conversation yesterday evening with John Fitzgerald, who formerly chaired the Climate Advisory Council, is still a member of that council today. And he kind of talked to me through some of the, you know, basically some of the basics, I'd say, on what exactly is going to be needed. And he talked about, for the thing that will impact on people the most is heating and their own homes. And he was saying that we need to get the vast majority of homes up to a B2 standard. And that would mean putting in a heat pump. And he was explaining even like a heat pump only produces water at 40 degrees, not 70 degrees. So you also have to insulate the home. You maybe need to go under the floors and put in underfloor heating. So he's saying that kind of investment is massive. It could be anywhere between 25,000 to 50,000 per household, which could be in all, a cost of 15 billion. And he was saying that like households would probably have to pay for the vast majority of that themselves, because from digging around yesterday, what the government are planning is they're looking at different options for households. So it could be that you were given a long-term, low-cost loan, or you could be offered like a green mortgage, which incorporates the price of doing that. But at the end of the day, you'll still have to pay that back yourself. You can have government subsidies, of course, but if the government was to fund the entire thing itself, I think there is an acceptance that that's not possible, that you need more than exchequer funding. You're going to need people to make this step change in their lives themselves. And you have to find, the government will have to find a way to convince people that this is worth doing to help people who can't. They'll also have to invest in the social housing stock themselves, naturally. And this will be one of the biggest things, he was saying, around telling people about what they can do themselves. And then kind of talking me through the different areas, obviously, in terms of electricity, in terms of agriculture, and all those different areas. And it really is, the task is absolutely massive. But his message was, it's doable if the right actions are taken at the right time and if the government finds a way to sell this. And the other thing as well is we're dealing at the moment where you have certain parties that are accused of populism. And you have to ask yourself, how does a populist message where you say, I don't support any measures such as an increase in carbon tax because we don't support, like say Sinn Féin don't support an increase in carbon tax because they say that's punitive on householders. But the fact of the matter is, any measures taken to address this are going to be punitive on everybody. So how do you marry that into politics where they're not necessarily good bedfellows? And how do you get politicians to think that they can actually sell this message to people when you and I both know that that's what politicians want to do? They feel if they can't sell something to someone, they're not going to get elected or not going to keep their seat. And it's a huge, huge challenge. And I think as time goes by and hopefully we move away from the pandemic and hopefully they make inroads with the housing crisis, this is the big, big issue.
Yeah, Jack, I mean, I was reading some of those quotes from John Fitzgerald in this morning's Irish Times. And, you know, there are facts tossed in there which are just hugely problematic for any government. And this one in particular, like he talks about how the number of skilled contractors who would be needed to do this retrofitting in the country basically, it would cut back enormously on the country's capacity to deal with the housing crisis. And then there's the whole question of the transformation of agriculture, which you can already see there's huge resistance to. And to be perfectly honest, you look at the records of previous Irish governments, all of which had either one or other of the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael parties in them, and they never met their targets. And those targets were an awful lot easier to achieve than the targets we're talking about now. So it is a massive, massive, massive political mountain to climb.
It is. And in some ways, it's a kind of, like Jen was talking about, the response to the pandemic. In some ways, it's an inverse public policy response to the pandemic, because the threat from the pandemic was very clear and overwhelmed hospitals and, you know, temporary morgues and all the rest of it, you know, whereas the pain from climate change is always not on the never never, but it's not immediate. So trying to kind of ram that home and make it make sense to the population has always been difficult. There are pinch points emerging around this, though. It's going to all this risk that we've known about for ages, political risk, climate risk, and how the two interact, they're going to crystallize in the next little while, partially around the things that Jen was talking about, the NDP and the Climate Action Plan, but also in parallel to the Climate Action Plan, the Climate Change Advisory Council, which is the body that John Fitzgerald is part of, at some stage over the next kind of 4, 6, 8 weeks, will deliver to the government its overall draft climate budget. And that's the kind of emissions budget. At that point, Eamon Ryan has to go off and consult with his cabinet colleagues about setting sectoral emission ceilings. These are the legally binding ones. This is the teeth that has been given to climate policy in the Climate Action Bill, Climate Action Act, that worked its way through the Oireachtas over the last kind of year or so. So that is going to be a very potentially tricky and hazardous political moment for the government. And that, I think, is when a lot of these, as I say, these risks begin to crystallise. Because while some of these departments are run by green ministers, run by Eamon Ryan himself, you know, so when he's talking to the transport minister, when he's talking to the energy minister, he's talking to himself. Others aren't. And, you know, the big and obvious one is the Department of Agriculture. And what are we going to do about emissions from the cattle herd? What kind of hard policy choices does that bring home? What is the impact on particularly small farmers? What exactly is going to pay for any compensation measures that are given to small farmers? And, you know, is there a risk around, you know, this being seen by rural Ireland as an attack on a way of life? And, you know, there are political risks inherent to those dialogues, which are, you know, emerging around the world, you know, insiders, outsiders, rural, urban, all the rest of it. So this could be a real moment of risk for the government around then. And I think that if Eamon Ryan and Charlie McConnellogue aren't actually sitting down right now during summer, and if the government isn't thinking about trying to look around those corners and detect those landmines now, and if they go off during the autumn and it becomes a problem within and between the coalition parties, I think they'll reap the whirlwind and there'll be no shortage of blame to go around. I think it's unavoidable that this would be a problem between government and people. But if the government doesn't have its act together, doesn't have its message straight, and doesn't have these tricky policy positions fleshed out and thought about, that is kind of unforgivable and could become a real point of kind of genuine peril, I think, for the government in September, October, November.
And maybe particularly in an internal party problem, both for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, Jen, given that both of those have their own sorts of rural-urban divides and resentments between differing wings of the party.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see like that the rural aspect of this becoming very problematic potentially and a very sticky issue. I mean, they're talking about, you know, retrofitting houses or upgrading houses. You can imagine that the houses, you know, where you've got kind of oil and peat, they would be kind of in rural areas. They'd be more expensive. These are the houses, I think, that would need kind of the most work. And that's a real problem, trying to convince people in rural areas who may not have the money to do this. I mean, it's all very well and good, people who have the money or savings talking about, you know, green schemes or whatever. But for the vast majority of people, this is probably beyond their reach. And it's trying to find a way to bridge that gap. And like it goes back to the point I made earlier on, especially politically, how do you sell this to people? You know, yes, people are absolutely terrified, but people have also had enough, I think, of awful news all the time. And you could hardly blame sections of the public if they kind of tuned out from the terrible news that the planet's in meltdown and that they need to spend 50 grand on a new electric car and underfloor heating. And like, this is going to be the problem. Like, how do you bridge that gap and how do you make this affordable? And how do you make it realistic to those sections of the population. And I can see it being a real bone of contention in those parties, which are already suffering kind of rural, amongst their rural voters, from a perception of being perhaps too Dublin-centric. You know, every time you listen to Fianna Fáil talk about their potential leadership election, they always talk about how they need a Dublin leader. There always has been that focus. So that is one element of it. And I think I mentioned as well, like the electric cars, they're like, that's going to be another huge transport. You know, a lot of, you know, the emissions that we see in our current life. How do you convince people, if you need to meet those targets, that they need to ditch their car now and move to an electric car, which could cost 25,000, 30,000 euros? And it's a really big ask, I think. It's a really, really difficult one. And I know that from talking to people in government who are at the moment, you know, preparing for the budget and preparing their figures and preparing this climate plan, that they're looking at kind of what's needed. And they're thinking this is going to be, you know, one of the biggest challenges that we face over the next couple of years.
One last thought before we go, Jack. I'm looking at Cathy Sheridan's column on the opinion page in the Irish Times today. It's about Sinn Féin's commemoration last week of the 40th anniversary of the death of the hunger striker Thomas McElwee. And it kicked up quite a bit of a fuss on social media and elsewhere because of the crime for which Thomas McElwee was convicted and that he was in prison for at the time of his death, which was the horrific death in a firebomb of a young woman. Does it tell us anything about how Sinn Féin still has some issues to overcome with what you might call Middle Ireland or mainstream Ireland before it becomes completely accepted? Or are these kind of issues now just such a matter of history that they don't impact too much on the voting intentions of people?
It's important, not so much in the specific instance, which I think will come and go. I mean, I don't think we're going to be talking about that specific tweet or this particular commemoration in a couple of days or a week's time. But there's a general kind of, there's a general lesson to take from it for Sinn Féin and for the parties that oppose them, the parties currently of government or you know, Labour and the Social Democrats as well. And that is that while I think, you know, there's obviously a large cohort of people who are attracted to Sinn Féin, either for kind of, you know, their specific policy stance, you know, around the housing question in particular, just for example, or because of their kind of general anti-government, anti-establishment stance, which punches through and appeals to people who believe that, you know, there is an insider outsider dynamic going on and that Sinn Féin are the party to tackle it. But it shows that there is an ongoing vulnerability related to the culture and history of the Sinn Féin organization and how it accommodates the history of the troubles within the current manifestation of the party, which is supportive of the peace process and against violence. And I think that all of those cohorts that might be attracted to Sinn Féin, for one reason, have large segments within them who are uncomfortable with that, who are uncomfortable with the culture of commemoration. And you will see, I think there's a soft underbelly for Sinn Féin on this, and you will see that as it goes about its business commemorating the past and, you know, acknowledging the history, that it presents multiple opportunities for the establishment parties, for want of a better construction, to point this out and to point out to Middle Ireland the facts that make them uncomfortable with the Sinn Féin organisation and with the history of republicanism. And, you know, that is something that I think will, you know, be a thread in Irish politics for the next cycle at least. And I think it'll come to a head whenever the next general election is, and this will be a massive point of differentiation that the establishment parties will seek to ram home, because they intuit, and I think that they intuit correctly, that there is a vulnerability in Sinn Féin around that. So to sum up, you know, this specific instance, not much turns on it, but generally there is a vulnerability there, and there is a political kind of wider strategic game at play here.
What Cathy says, Jen, and I quote from her piece here, the point is that Sinn Féin alone continues to eulogise the perpetrators and to selectively remember the past while calling for an early border pull. And it does so while calling for a shared culture of commemoration in Irish society, north and south, and upon the principles of mutual respect, dignity and sensitivity. And I think she has a point there about there is a certain type of language and a very one-sided version of the events of the Troubles, I think, in things like those commemorations and those tweets and the words used in them. That is still jarring to me anyway. It may not be jarring to lots of people, but it is to me.
Yeah, I was very interested to read the same point, and I think that's the reason why there's often... It's so problematic, I think, the way, for some people, the way Sinn Féin do commemorate the various different figures. And we've seen this many times over the last couple of years, and it's going to crop up continuously. And when you listen to the defence given by people like Owen O'Brien over the last couple of days, their defence basically is that, you know, it's their right to commemorate figures that were influential or important in the movement. But that, of course, once you commemorate certain figures, you run the risk of upsetting other families or other people who are impacted. But the problem is exactly what you say. It's the way you do it, and it's the language that you use. And you would have to think that surely there must be a better way of doing it that doesn't always lead to this these kind of issues. And from my own perspective, I often wonder when I see them commemorating whoever it may be, and obviously we've the example you gave this week, why they haven't figured out a way to do it that doesn't create such heartache and angst. Because we have to remember, this isn't, you know, the distant past. This is all still quite recent. It's all still very fresh. And we're coming up to another sensitive time, I think, in the decade of centenaries, and we're going to be talking about the Civil War and all that kind of stuff. And it is a tricky area. And you would have to think there is a better way of doing it that doesn't, you know, because I think there was a criticism as well in this case of somebody in the background shouting up the rah. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to get behind that. And I don't think the party can defend that either. I think there must be a better way to do it. But they don't seem to be keen on pursuing that avenue at the moment.
Right, so we shall leave it there. Thanks very much to Jen and to Jack for joining us today. Thanks also to our producer, Suzanne Brennan, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. Do remember that you can mail us with your thoughts and your questions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com, but we'll be back very soon. Talk to you then.